what I've said is Meltzer is trying to get to the top of the mountain. He thinks you can get, as a writer, to the top of the mountain and expose what's being the conditioning factors and what we're being duped by. He does not understand what McLuhan knows, is that you can't get to that point of perspective. We're all inside the Android meme, and everybody participates in it regardless of your stance. Meltzer doesn't get that. Now, Zappa gets that on his level. Not as deep as McLuhan, but he gets. In the end, Foucault was saying, well, maybe I'm just an entertainer here to play, you know, that last song. Maybe it's not, it's not me to say, I'm not here to say, point out, and criticize, I'm just here to play, you know. Zappa has an intuition of everything being swallowed up by the electric vortex. And that's why he criticizes student radicals like Hoffman and everybody. He criticizes everybody because they don't know how big the TV environment is. And he does say it. You know, there's a couple of quotes there. He comes across as kind of a middle-class conservative. He recognizes you can't beat these huge forces, but maybe we could handle them a bit better by improving the content or not being such Puritans about sex and different things like that. Here's the thing. Meltzer is trying to be on the top of the mountain. He sees that.
I don't know if I agree with that, but go on.
Yeah.
Go on.
Well, you'll get this one. So Meltzer's looking at Zappa. He wants to be on the top of the mountain. He sees that Zappa is perceived as being on the top of the mountain, and that Zappa seems to be believing he's on the top of Zappa's mountain, and Meltzer objects to that. He says Zappa's not doing it right. It's almost Meltzer's almost seeing, now this is what's interesting, he's almost saying, well, Frank is trying to make revolutionary music, and that's not the issue anymore. It's not revolutionary music. Revolutionary music is whatever's happening. So here's the interesting point, is that Meltzer has the McLuhan view in his puny little perspective, and he thinks Zappa doesn't have it. Zappa has the McLuhan view that he's not just a musician, he's on a political agenda, and so Zappa knows that he's not limited to being the top musician that Meltzer's projecting that Zappa thinks.
So say that again. Say that again. The last sentence. He knows
Meltzer is.
Zappa knows that he's not.
Yeah, Zappa knows that you cannot. Zappa knows he's being seen as a genius musician, but he knows, almost like Meltzer, that being a genius musician is irrelevant. That's why he's going into politics. He's going into a bigger happening, a bigger sculptural concept of molding the environment. So Zappa knows that he is that people are being misled, thinking that he's all out to be a genius musician. And Meltzer thinks Zappa is thinking that and resents that. But Zappa actually knows that the environment is bigger than Zappa and bigger than Meltzer. Meltzer knows the environment is bigger than Zappa. McLuhan definitely knows it.
Well, so that's interesting because that's the rock critics in general have almost like had a chip on their shoulder about Zappa for that exact reason. I think they sort of treat Zappa like, here's this guy who thinks he's so smart, but they're not really maybe getting like that what he's doing. I don't know.
Okay. The thing is, everybody actually half sees what McLuhan's talking about. They all know. That's why the popular version of McLuhan is, you'll be famous for 15 minutes and that's it. Okay,
right.
So everybody knows that by the 70s in the entertainment business and all levels, you know, all the rock critics. And they don't see it as deeply as McLuhan, but they use the Warhol thing. So if anybody goes around thinking that they're on top of this whole thing and they can produce art that lasts a long time or they can pull off something that has staying power, Chris Gell and those guys will say, well, he's deluded, you know. And they thought Zappa had that attitude. They didn't know he didn't have that attitude.
Okay, yeah.
He always said, this is just for me, his music. But that's just the music. But he also was working on another level and ran for president finally in 91. You know, then he got cancer and it stopped, but he was starting to talk about it. And you will hear an amazing statement in the last interview. He describes it. At the end of the interview, he describes how he would run for president. He's thinking about it. And you know what he'd do? He said, I wouldn't campaign at all. I'd just sit home here and take phone calls. Now McLuhan said years ago, way back, you know, in the 60s, 70s, that you can run a presidential election from a TV studio. You don't need to do all this running around campaign. You just have debates and interactions in a TV studio.
Yeah.
Okay? He's actually saying very close the same thing as Zappa. Zappa has an instinctive understanding of that. Knows it's just a media phenomenon, so I just do it from my home. And McLuhan's saying the same thing. That's what's interesting, how Zappa is like a McLuhanite, unconscious McLuhanite, in the American context. He definitely is not on the international context that McLuhan's working. You know, McLuhan's working with all different kinds of cultures. But,
right.
Okay, so here's Zappa. He knows more than Meltzer recognizes, but he will allow, he will, remember, he's invading the music scene. As one of those famous DJs in Q107 interviewed Zappa early 80s, and I spoke to him after, and he says, you know, he's saying, it was fun, but, you know, Zappa's a snob. Zappa's a snob. And right. You know, if you know Frank, he was not a snob, but when he walked in, it was a military operation. He walked into a radio station, he would be there to criticize it, not talk about the puny thing about music or what's happening. He would often criticize it by making fun of other stars, but he was always talking about serious, quote, serious political issues.
Right, right.
And for most people, that's boring. What a boring crank Zappa is, talking about, you know, immigration or something. And where they just want to...
He was punking that way, too, I would say. But anyway, go on.
Yeah, but he was a literate punk. I mean, he wouldn't just express disdain about whatever's going on. Okay, you're
right.
Saying the punks were political?
Yeah, I guess I'm just saying that it wasn't just about music for him in that way. And I think that is kind of very similar. Like, when I say punk, I guess I'm putting him in the vein more of like a Johnny Rotten or something like that.
Right, and they come in and snub their nose at everybody and tell everybody to piss off. And they understood the politics of that, but they could not sit down and talk about issues too well, too articulately for very long.
No.
You know, they couldn't... See, when you go into another environment, you got to be able to put on that you know what you're talking about. Zappa could go into any environment and put on what he was doing, appropriate
right.
to the
well,
situation.
He did the thing with the PMRC or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, was a brilliant sort of move, and, yeah.
He cut his hair, he presented his image, he knew exactly where he was going, and the ground rules. And you know the story that he got background information from Mae Brussel, thanks to me telling him about Mae Brussel.
Okay, no, I didn't know that.
Yeah, he called her up just before he went and said, give me the dirt on all these guys. So she told him, you know, the skeletons and all the major politicians he was going to deal with in their background. He didn't use it, but it gave him some ammunition that he could feel confident or superior to them, because he had the goods on them. You know what I mean?
That's interesting, yeah.
Yeah.
That he didn't use it, but he just knowing it...
Helped him feel superior to them and to say, these are little puny, corrupt guys. They got... They're fakes, you know? They're not... They're fakes. That's what he would go in with that. And he knew that he could not be intimidated by them.
Yeah, okay.
And he gave May, this is 1985, he gave May a computer after that as his little present to her.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
But anyways, and that was because I gave him some Mae Brussel tapes in August 84 at the Limelight in New York City. That was at William Irwin Thompson's Lindisfarne Institute that we talk about in my dialogues with Scott around my book, Fatty Communion. William Irwin Thompson, you know, good mind, worth knowing what he's saying. The Limelight was taken over from his David Rockefeller-funded institute on the corner of West 20th and 6th Avenue, New York City, and was made a disco by a famous Canadian guy who in the 90s got busted. Peter somebody?
I don't know.
He had a big disco empire, got busted for drug dealing or having that in the Limelight thing. But in August 84, Zappa was there one night, and I went there. He was there just featured to sign autographs, just sitting in the side of the disco. And I told him about May and said, I'm going to send you these tapes. And then he played in Nova Scotia November 6, 1984, in Halifax. And I met with him the next day, and we discussed the tapes that he had received by that time.
Huh.
And then he called May up in August 85, September 85, because the Congress thing was September 19th, 85, I think. He called up May a few weeks before and got the information. And then I was always in touch with May, and I called her up. I didn't know that had happened. And she says, hey, Zappa called me, and she knew of Zappa and told me. And then I started to say, well, you know, She says, I know you caused this, Bob. I know this came to me from you. And she knew that just intuitively. Then I told her how it happened, the details. Anyways, why are we saying all this? Oh, yeah. So he that was for musicians, that was a concept, a performance he did as a musician. Post John Cage, anything you do and you claim it's a composition, it's a composition.
Right, right, okay.
But that's just a category for the critics. You know, Zappa's a great artist. He can think in those terms. He's a multimedia artist. Yeah, but Zappa wouldn't limit himself to just that. He was still trying to become president.
Right, okay.
So, and that was all music. But it was only music for those that thought music was an important private concern. That's why I say he was more than a musician, more than any category you want to put on him.
Right, okay.
But Melch and them, they're all concerned about music. And this guy has some kind of authority in it. He's really good, but his attitude's off. Or he's not a tribal guy. He's an old-fashioned, literate, isolated individualist, you know?
Okay.
So he's just
Okay, well, the only I guess, thing I sort of was about your calling Meltzer or saying, you know, he was trying to get to the top of the mountain kind of thing. I don't know. I mean...
No, he was trying to write... You know what it means to be top of the mountain? He was trying to offer a writerly expression that x-rayed everything. And he knew, you can see it in the things we did in session two, he knew that how impossible it was to do that.
Right, right. So you're not saying it is some kind of status sort of movie?
No. He was saying, you know, that Aesthetics of Rock is like celebrating some stupid, you know, song by Smokey Robinson or something. You know, not that stupid, but just a transitory pleasure. And then trying to relate it to the meaning of experience, all these philosophical categories that he had gotten in college, his literate background. And he knows even that's silly. So he's like, the point is that Zappa, Meltzer, and McLuhan are seeing the same thing, but only McLuhan would explain why Meltzer and Zappa see it.
Okay.
See, Meltzer thinks he's seeing something. McLuhan knew, he'd gone through the vanishing point, even seeing from the level of the medium as a massage was, quote, futile, you know, under Android meme, global theater conditions.
Right. Although he was in... Well, the Android meme is getting ahead of him, though, isn't it?
No, the Android meme started in the 60s, and he starts making references to, not that term, but the same simulated... He writes about psychedelics positively in the mid-60s. He writes about the cyborg phenomenon in 65, 66. He's right up on what MIT and the leading thinkers before it becomes Wired magazine are talking about, you know, 20 years before. And, so I'm saying that the position in this amazing environment that's both, as Arthur Crooker says, ecstatic and depressing, this is the way we live. We live oscillate between ecstasy from whatever we're digging, the information input, and the isolation that the environment creates. For no chemical body, human scale community. So we go between ecstasy and manic depression all the time. So here's McLuhan explaining why, and Zappa wrestling with it a little more comprehensively than Meltzer, and Meltzer wrestling with it within the writerly medium. So, see, Meltzer doesn't know, because music is a concern, it's his art almost, what he's addicted to. He thinks Zappa is a musician and an old-fashioned musician. And then you get into that complex stuff in his articles about irony and put-on, and it's all interesting. We could find them and quote some of them. It's pretty interesting how he tries to categorize. Zappa is an ironist, but he's not super ironic like the Beatles.
Right. Well, actually, I've got that quote in front of me. Let's look at it, actually. So it's page 8. Of Aesthetics of Rock, I think in the printout or the web stuff I sent you, I think it's the very first one, actually. So in the footnote, there's some reference in the main body of the text to the phrase senseless masochism. So he says in the footnote, you know, senseless masochism. But that of Frank Zappa and the Mothers surpasses Lennon's because the former seems to have missed, perhaps by having become too old for a while, the whole sequence of English rock explosions. Consequently, Zappa thinks he has to bother with empty parodies of early rock emptiness without realizing that the Beatles and everybody else have coped with that work problem. That is senseless masochism, especially when there's nothing else left from before to bother with, and gotten it well out of the way and or internalized it as second nature roughage. And he never parodies much of England except Donovan. Okay, well, there's a lot in there to unpack, but
no.
But it sounds like he's kind of saying, I don't know, like Zappa and one is surpassing Lennon, but what he's actually doing is already been done by the Beatles.
That
kind of confusing.
Yeah, and that is an excellent perception if you understand McLuhan. I mean, this is a symptom of the dilemma McLuhan's pointing out. And Meltzer is, you know, intuitively expressing it, but he doesn't fully get it. He personalizes it too much. So
here, right, very personalized that. And that's, I'll let you say your point, but that's another interesting thing about Zappa in the book Aesthetics of Rock. It's one of the few people that Meltzer almost kind of, he tweaks towards the personal with him for some reason.
Yeah, he's not going to say Zappa's worth all the adulation he's getting. And Meltzer is right. That you know, a guru of music is irrelevant in our global theater. He's right about that, but he doesn't know that Frank knows that.
Okay.
He's being fooled by Frank being. I mean, Frank would be the haughty composer in certain situations, and then just the good old boy in another situation. He was changing depending on who he was with and who he wanted to be contrary with or not.
Right.
He probably that later article where. Meltzer meets Frank in Glotzer's office, and I've been to been at Glotzer's office at that time, right around that time, about 77. And he's like a little kid, and he feels like Zappa's the master by then, because this what we just read is written 10 years before.
That's right. Yeah.
So there he's before a guy who has established a certain powerful reputation, but he knows it's an illusion. Meltzer knows that this is something silly, and he thinks Frank believes it. And Frank probably knows, though I'm not sure, he probably knows a bit about Meltzer and knows that Meltzer is a guy trying to get to the top of the mountain of anti-environmental role-playing. And Zappa then puts on this whole haughty thing in relation to him as a joke on Meltzer.
Right, okay.
He gets fooled by the role Zappa puts on in front of Meltzer.
Although Zappa hated the critics, though.
Nah, he didn't. He would say that to the critics just to bug them.
Okay.
If he was, I mean, he didn't. Zappa didn't, on his public opinionator, he didn't like anything.
Well, one thing that's okay.
But that's not the way he was privately. He liked a lot.
Yeah. No. I'm sure. But there are. I know now of two anecdotes where, and I mean, it's only two, but I think it's just interesting. In that piece you're referring to, where Meltzer went to interview him, he tells a little story about how. Zappa called up some newspaper because, you know, they got all their facts wrong about the show or whatever.
Yeah.
And then in an interview, I forget where it was. It was something I think I saw online, actually, or an MP3 I found online with Lester Bangs, an interview from 1980, a great interview. And he gives some anecdote about Zappa, and Bangs did not like Zappa at all. Like,
right,
him,
right.
It's not even a begrudging kind of respect. Although early on, I think he did like him. But he mentions this story about how, I think in Cream magazine in the mid-70s when Bangs was there, they slagged one of Zappa's records, and he had put an ad in the same issue, like on the back cover or something, and Frank was so pissed off that he called up Cream and was complaining to them, and then Bangs said, you know, he wrote off this letter to him saying, you know, I'm sorry, Mr. Multimedia Genius, something like that. So,
yeah.
So it's funny that, like, Frank would actually, on these different occasions, sort of pick up the phone, you know, and call these magazines to complain about what they're doing. I find that really fascinating.
Well, and Zappa understood that electric media reduced everything to human scale. And you know, back 100 years ago, you couldn't write Charles Dickens if you read him in the States or something. You could write him, but you couldn't call him up directly. Zappa used the technology, just like he did with rock music or trying to become president. He says, I can get into this mix, and these guys think you can write stuff and it goes out there. They're talking to me. I'm right here, and I'm going to call you up and call you on it.
Right, right, yeah.
And that was an anti-environmental gesture by Zappa. It was a put-on.
Yeah. Well, and I think that ties in a bit, I think, with what I think one of the valuable things in Ben's book is he's constantly kind of pointing out how, and, you know, this is maybe a kind of even a bit of a Marxist thing, too, and that there's always this kind of demystification thing sort of happening with Zappa. Like, he's always kind of he's always dealing with exactly what's going on, and he's telling you about it.
He's in your face.
So he's not like just if he's got a gripe with the magazine, you think, you know, fuck it, I'll call him and, you know.
Yeah,
rather than observe that there's this line between critics and musicians or something.
That's right. He's in your face. And I mean, all his early albums are in your face.
Yeah.
And he knew that's what the Electric Drummer, I mean, he may not have technically spelled out like McLuhan could, but he instinctively knew that. I mean, right on Absolutely Free, he says, the CIA is creeping around Laurel Canyon, and he also begins by saying the president is sick. You know, he goes right to the highest levels and confronts her right there on the album. So he knows, okay, Ben's book. Ben's good because he knows that Zappa is confronting everybody in the present and is doing it as a put-on, but also multi-level put-on. It can be serious as much as you want to take it. Remember what Dylan says on the liner notes of John Wesley Harding, the little story about Zappa. Three kings come to Zappa, and they ask, what's up? And he says, well, how far do you want to go in? And that's Zappa's ready to go all the way if you want to. So Ben does that. Ben does a book on Zappa as a put-on to get into your face because you missed the meaning of the punk movement and you missed the meaning of Theodore Adorno and you missed the meaning of the Socialist Party and Marx. You know what I mean? He just hijacked Zappa for other purposes. Zappa did the same thing. And the Zappa fans don't understand that when Ben does that, Zappa right back at them.
Right, right, yeah. Yeah, they just complain that he got a few facts wrong or something.
Yeah, or they say, well, Ben, Zappa never read Shakespeare or this and that, you know, and they think that's... No, it's not. It's
right.
Not.
That's not the point.
Yeah, it's a tradition of put-on, of satirical manipian put-on that Ben does. He didn't know he was a manipian. He didn't know that word, but now he realizes that he was that.
Okay, so that's the point, though. This is going back to last week's conversation. I mean, that's what Lipstick Traces is. Like, you kind of put me a little on the spot last week. Rightly so, you know, saying, well, what did you get out of Lipstick Traces? What was it about or whatever? And I mean, it's very similar in that regard. It's basically different voices, you know, from the century, people completely unknown to each other having a conversation with each other.
Right. And that is, okay, first of all, I'd say he's celebrating certain critics. Different strategies of criticism, of anti-environmental shamanism. But he doesn't get the obsolescence of every one of those moves. He's celebrating them and doesn't know why they're obsolete. So it becomes just a book of art history. It's just a book. If you want to really be a relevant critic, don't make your book a book. And that's what Ben's book is, not a book about Frank, even though it's apparently that. So he's saying there's this conversation going on. Well, he doesn't include the advertisers and how they're the.
Not true. He does actually. He does. I mean, he does pull ads and stuff into his book. I think I'm pretty sure he does. Like,
yeah, but does he say they're of equal momentum as the Situationists or the Sex Pistols?
Well, I mean, he may not he may not devote as much space to them, but he's still pulling them in. I mean, does McLuhan like? Quote advertisers with the equal momentum that he does Joyce. I mean,
yes, he did a whole book.
Part of the mill.
He did a whole book on it on ads. Two
okay,
of them.
Well, that,
but
yeah.
But here's the thing: is that Marcus will select interesting ads that he thinks are neat, just like he selects the interesting art movements like the.
Well, okay, but it's more than that. They're neat. It's that they're speaking in this same language. This, which he would call a mysterious language,
yes.
That he's trying to figure out. But he's not just pulling them because they've got some neat picture on them or something like that. Like, he's actually quoting them and trying to make sense of what they're doing with, and you know, showing how, you know, here's this ad completely, you know, unconnected, and it seems to be, it's like it's Dadaist or something like that.
Right, and he doesn't know that advertising as a whole environment. Regardless of what ads you like or don't like, advertising as a function itself really upsets everybody way more than the Sex Pistols or the Situationists or whoever else he has in there. And that's what McLuhan would say. He said Abbie Hoffman came on Mike Douglas on one of those shows in 68 and declared his Yippie Revolution, and then Marshall says, and then the advertisement came on and canceled it immediately.
Right.
The advertisement function itself is the manipian situation is Sex Pistols' environment. That's what, they don't even have a clue. Marcus doesn't have a clue. He's trying to figure out what's pure consumption and what isn't. Or what's political, political sign system or political meaning. And whereas Zappa gets to that level of McLuhan almost, not as, as complex or complete, but he understands. I mean, look, do you know anybody who came up with a song in the middle of it goes, so what the fuck? You know, that's such a great line in the middle of a song. Where Zappa is expressing the cancellation of any effort immediately due to the electronic global theater. So what the fuck? It's hilarious.
Well, that reminds me of Aesthetics of Rock, kind of. Like, the more I do think about Aesthetics of Rock and Frank Zappa, like, the more I do see them as parallel efforts. And, I do agree with you that Zappa's taking it further just by sheer dint of the fact that he's using more mediums. And not just music, but, music is obviously the primal one, but he's also, suiting up and, doing the PMRC thing and the running for president and all that stuff.
And calling up people and hassling them. just calling them up. And which is what Wyndham Lewis was the first prank caller. Did you know that?
No.
He would, back when phones were around. I don't know if it
was going to say the phones must have just been sort of pretty still. Were these phones still a new? No, they would have been around for what, 20 years by that point?
Yeah, sometime in the 20s or 30s. I'm not sure when.
Okay.
Wyndham Lewis, every morning, would go take out the phone book and, accidentally, haphazardly pick a number. Just place his finger blindly in the middle of the book or something.
Wow.
Call that number and harangue the person for a couple of minutes. They wouldn't even know who he was.
That's amazing.
Yeah. He was a phone prank call. He knew he could. It was his art. Yeah, I'll wake this guy. Here's a number. I'm going to call this guy and wake him up.
Wow.
Why wait to put a painting in the gallery that guy may never see? I have a medium, a telephone, to call anybody and harass them. Or do an aesthetic data move on them.
Yeah.
Isn't that amazing?
No, that's totally amazing. Did he write about that? He must have told. I guess
people knew about it. I can't remember where I heard about it. I mean, I spoke to him when I was young, but I didn't know that stuff, so I didn't ask. But other people written about it. Maybe Hugh Kenner writes about it in one of his famous books on Wyndham Lewis.
Okay.
But that sensibility of looking at what's available. I mean, he's on duty. Wyndham Lewis every day. Okay, who am I? Joyce ends Portrait of the Artist as Young Man with the line, and it's supposed to be Stephen Dedalus saying it. I go forth for the millionth time to forge the uncreated conscience of my race, and that's the. End of the book. Well, Lewis would say, well, Joyce, that's rather dramatic. Why, have you called up anybody today? Have you harassed somebody with the latest medium? Rather than writing a book where you claim you're forging the uncreated conscience of your race?
Right.
And that's what Zappa has. It's very interesting how Zappa and Joyce Zappa and Beefheart physiologically can look like Joyce and Beefheart, mix them up. And look like Joyce and Beefheart, Zappa they look like Joyce and Lewis.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
Zappa and Beefheart.
So why do you think...
Here's the thing. Hold that thought. Just want to complete what we're saying.
Yeah.
So Meltzer, he can only bug people by writing a review. Whereas Frank can get radio interviews and do all kinds of stuff.
He did the radio show, and I think he actually did get booted off. And actually, let me just tell you one thing. He actually did a preamble, apparently, before the last Sex Pistols concert at, I think it was at Winterland in San Francisco or something.
You mean up on stage?
Yeah, like he was actually, not like an MC, I don't think, but he was actually sort of went up to almost give like a kind of performance art or something, or a spiel. And apparently it was like just so offensive that I think even Grill Marcus wrote some piece I think Meltzer actually said, well, Marcus never liked my book initially he never liked me after I did my thing at the Sex Pistols, but, I actually upset him more than, the Sex Pistols did probably, because I guess he just went up and, was saying all this, really, just the most vile kind of stuff, I guess.
Yeah, he was trying to do a Zappa. He was.
Yeah.
See, this is the point. Meltzer and Zappa have the same perception, same goals. Zappa a little more comprehensive. He has more abilities and more media he can work with. But that's why Meltzer presents himself as a little puny Lilliputian in relation to the master. You know what I mean? And Bangs had the same kind of grievance. That's why he called him multimedia genius. You have access to way more than I do. I just got the Village Voice or Cream Magazine.
That's interesting, yeah.
You know, and so they're writers. And they're saying, damn it, this guy, he doesn't have to be a writer. He's not starving. He can play music and enter and bug people on a whole levels, bigger levels. So that's going to make them feel inferior and resentful.
That's what it. Yeah, like I thought there was some kind of resentment the way Bang said multimedia genius, but that gets it.
Yeah, and you can use McLuhan for the bigger frame to get into these things. You can talk about, you know, this is a literate culture, baby boomers up against an acoustic space environment, and you can get into all this sociological, anthropological levels, and then go over and read French rock critics. If you could read them, translate them, and then do the sociological on them. McLuhan go around the whole planet discussing all the little Lester Bangs in the different countries. You know what I mean?
Right, yeah.
And the Meltzers. Okay, that's a big level. Now, within American culture, Zappa is a mini McLuhan in relation to Meltzer, who's a James Carey, angry that Zappa is not hanging out with him and down in the bar or something, or hanging out with punk groups, you know, not helping with the draft resistors, which is what James Carey felt about McLuhan, right?
Okay, yeah.
And multimedia genius means you're everywhere. You're all over the place. You're not just worried about writing in voice in the Village Voice or Cream Magazine. Have you ever seen the... remember Cream Magazine had Boy Howdy?
Yeah,
profiles.
Their mascot, yeah, the Boy Howdy profiles. Yeah, Zappa's in there, I'm pretty sure, right?
Yes, in the middle 70s, there's Zappa. I don't know if it was real or not. Zappa is standing in front of a truck and a plane, and the, of course, the Boy Howdy profile. They don't get mad at Frank in it. You know, they kind of just say he's a great guy and all this and the little details. But there's Zappa. At that time, he's got his own plane, his own truck. He's got everything. He's got all these vehicles he can use. Now, it might have been just that one time, or it might have been a put-on. He may not have had that plane. But Zappa had himself photographed with all these resources. That's the picture of him in the Boy Howdy profile.
Yeah.
And what's interesting, I think it's in that profile. He did say this, or he got them to say this, the basic... like chief feature at the bottom, it says permanently stuck in 1966, which is, I can see Zappa allowing that to be put in because most of his fan base was, they couldn't,
yeah,
they didn't like the way he was going in 75. He was moving into other stuff.
Right. Okay.
So, but what's interesting is you got Meltzer and McLuhan and Zappa having the same chemical body brain perception, right? You're just a brain. You can see. You can't see everything. You're not a satellite camera, but you can look and you see. And you've got that Manipian detachment, and you can see through the con, the air sets and the environments all around you. Meltzer and Zappa and McLuhan have that, but McLuhan's older. He's got a lot more range of experience and knowledge than they do. They're just young kids compared to McLuhan.
Right. Yeah.
So let's look at what Meltzer says about McLuhan.
Let's look at that one, yeah.
Okay, where is that? I have a few of these.
The very first...
Right.
...that I sent to you.
Okay, so what... You know, this... You have him say at the bottom, as mere TV... I want to go back and deal with that statement on Zappa. That's really good. You know, this
the one about the Beatles.
Senseless stuff, masochism or whatever.
Right.
But...
Let's do this McLuhan one.
Yeah. As mere TV personalities, the monkeys are the standard McLuhan-esque, in quotes, then he puts ha, which is like he self-consciously knows something, it means something to him to go ha.
Right.
Or he's, okay.
It's almost like, yeah, right, almost, or something a little bit. That's how I sort of see it.
Yeah. McLuhan-esque was a criticism back then when he's writing this, so he's almost self-consciously, yeah, I'll use your term, McLuhan-esque, but... I'm going to
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The monkeys are the standard McLuhan-esque non-personal personalities. Okay, where's the next? I got to get the next part. Perfect. Where does he say? Perfect example of even hack McLuhan's inability to cope with the Beatles super personality in films of them as Beatle films. Now, what he's trying to say there is exactly what McLuhan can do.
See, okay, so let me take a stab, and you'll obviously go 50 paces.
Yeah, I'll go run around the lot. I'll lap you 10 times.
And I'll just be waving as you go.
Yeah, you're the little Lilliputian. Let's say your puny English language attempt. Okay.
Well, no, but he I think it's kind of a generational thing, obviously. I think it's, and I mean, it is kind of puny. But he's saying, you know, this guy could never really get right inside of, you know, he could never fully understand this monkeys Beatles thing the way I could, because I'm here living the life, and he must see him as some guy with, like, you know, a tie who is, like, you know, sort of suddenly all the rage or whatever.
Okay.
By calling him a hack and saying his inability to cope, it's like, you know, this guy he can't really see what's going on.
Right. Now, here's the incredible irony. The phrase, non-personal personality, that means they're iconic figures. Okay? Iconic. They don't have private points of view. They're there as a marketed image to teenagers to make teenagers believe there's still humans on the planet.
Right.
Okay? The music industry does not want kids to find out that it's just an android meme, a Gorgon monster that gives them no place to stand. Okay,
right.
The non-personal personalities are exactly what McLuhan said the Beatles were. Okay, he's saying McLuhan can't, and that's why he says McLuhan-esque. He kind of realizes,
right.
But he goes, "Hi." He kind of realizes. Okay, he's sort of agreeing with me that the monkeys are serving the iconic role that McLuhan first defined for the TV environment. Okay, let's...
Right.
As
right.
mere TV personalities, the monkeys are the standard McLuhan-esque non-personal personalities. A perfect example of even Hack McLuhan's inability to cope with the Beatles super personality in films of them as Beatle films. Now, McLuhan understood that the Beatles brought back human scale, that the global theater, paradoxically, brought back human scale, and that they were appearing to be super personalities, not non-personal personalities. The very thing he's saying McLuhan doesn't see is what McLuhan pointed out in the 60s. But he doesn't know McLuhan well enough. He's just taking the standard. He knew McLuhan said something about TV personalities are iconic. Yes.
Yeah.
But that is in the 50s. You have iconic personalities in the 50s. As the satellite shrinks these environments and allows you, gives you the perception that you can float around all these media, then it becomes one-on-one, which is what Frank's doing. He's calling up Cream Magazine and talking to you directly. The Beatles are super personalities, super identifiable, anthropomorphic entities that can be in everybody's environment because of the mixed corporate media world of the global theater by the 60s. It's not just black and white TV. You got radio, magazines, all this stuff is blossoming. What I call broke spirals of media on my chart. You've got all this stuff, and the Beatles can be show up in radio shows. I mean, radio stations, and meet with the mayor, which Lennon complained about. They're available. Okay, that's super personality. And then he's saying, but he's really talking about the film and films of them as Beatle films.
Right.
So that even the Beatles, their films were casual, interpersonal. They were like kids just playing in the film medium, hijacking the film, the great archetypal Hollywood film medium. And you got to be a qualified director to make one of those movies. They did just come in and play fun in front of the camera, right?
Right, right.
Okay,
yeah.
That's providing human scale for the youth market and creating a genre called Beatle films. But McLuhan would write about that. See, this is the thing, is that Meltzer is taking the, what I call the Madison Avenue, hardly read version of McLuhan. People didn't read McLuhan enough to figure out the sophisticated level McLuhan was talking about in the 60s that Meltzer is claiming McLuhan doesn't get. He definitely gets that. And McLuhan even meets the Beatles and stirs Lennon up. And you see, as I told you, I guess last week, you know, read the interaction with John Lennon by McLuhan.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. McLuhan upset Lennon. Lennon felt that he was not as hip as McLuhan when he met him.
Yeah.
Okay, the monkey pole move has always been obviously inevitable. And that's android memic. The overstatement of its eventual actuality is its rock grandeur. You see, once rock became a guaranteed environment in the 60s, after the Beatles made it acceptable, then it was marketed by the Android meme as the monkeys, the cloning of it.
Right.
And so the over... And that was inevitable because music was a huge environment that kids needed all around the world, and that industry would carry on, and the revolution of whatever people thought the Beatles were, and then when they went and met the Beatles, they saw a million other kids were there too. Well, where are all these other kids? I thought Dylan was speaking to me, you know?
Right, yeah.
The impersonality of that environment, and then the Beatles, the monkeys overstated. It's not an overstatement. It can be seen that way. I can see his point. But the overstatement of its eventual actuality is its rock grandeur because the monkeys are accepting the role of ersatz rock for the teenagers who are going to need it inside the global theater. It's what Croker writes in the 90s about, the recombinant commodity. Recombinant commodity. It's like a genetic engineered cloning of the media environments. You know, I went to a panel at DIA, famous art
right.
museum institute in New York, and Crisco and all these rock critics get up there, and they were doing their bit, and I got up and I said, "You guys are all genetic engineers, and you have no clue of what you're producing." That's how I began. I won't go into all the details. I announced they were genetic engineers. Okay, so that's
how
another
that
topic.
Well, how did that go? Did anyone?
Well, they snickered. The one
because I've heard about that specific conference. I think the DIA. Yeah, the all the rock critic. Was that like in mid '90s or early '90s or something?
Late '90s. Dina Weinstein.
Late '90s.
You know the name Dina Weinstein?
Yeah, she's got a book on metal I've got. Yeah.
Yes. Okay, Dina is the wife of Michael Weinstein, and Weinstein is the co-writer of Data Trash with Arthur Croker. And I was quoting Arthur Croker and Michael, her husband, back to her.
Okay.
And she was the only one who kind of snickered. I don't know how savvy she is of her husband's work, but I think she kind of knew what I was doing. You know what I mean?
Okay.
And she came up after and walked over to me and started looking at me. I was talking to someone else. She comes over and stands and listens to what I'm saying to somebody. And she was looking at me and she was sizing me up and she was sort of twinkling and that she said, "Nah, I don't think I'll talk to him." Or I didn't make an effort to talk to her. But but she was she said, "This guy is where did he come from?" kind of thing. And I think you can get the transcript of that conference.
Oh, really? I should. Yeah,
something like that. But that's where I confronted Crisco about Zappa. That was on a private level, but that's another thing. But anyways, I went into the rock critic world and tried to say what I'm getting an opportunity now to say way back then, 10 years ago.
Yeah, okay. So look at the footnote there on the page.
Yeah, okay. So then he says, just to continue that sentence, the overstatement of its eventual actuality is its rock grandeur. That's cliche, McLuhan's title, cliched archetype. The cliche of rock music is archetypalized by the monkeys within a clone society and their necessary recombinant commodities.
Okay.
So, I can understand exactly what Meltzer is trying to get at and then point out how he misses the guy who said it before Meltzer did, McLuhan.
Right.
And being, quote, quite prepared for that eventuality has been big since Hard Day's Night anyway. Well, that's my point. Hard Day's Night set the cliche, and then it became archetypalized. Or you could say reverse, depending. The Hard Day's Night's the archetype, and monkeys are the cliche replay.
Right. Okay.
But he is actually perceiving it's archetypal, the monkeys, because the way he says the overstatement of its eventual actuality. In other words, the archetypalization of its eventual actuality, which is the cliche, the archetypalization of its cliché is its rock grandeur, which is like archetypalized squared.
Okay.
Okay, so at the bottom he says, McLuhan's only move is the pop status he has inadvertently attained, and his jargon is nice as misused plagiarism. Now,
it's true that it's not his only move, but I mean the pop status is inadvertently attained, right?
That
in itself is not an incorrect statement.
It's
hardly his only move. I mean, that's, you know, when he puts that tweak on it, it's kind of ridiculous.
No. McLuhan was Howard Gossage, the advertising genius, who, quote, got all those magazine articles written about McLuhan. He approached McLuhan, said he was going to do it, and McLuhan could have said, no, I'm not a sellout, or whatever he would say. He agreed to it. McLuhan welcomed the pop status, but he did not.
Sorry, tell me that again. That was actually a, like, this was something specifically, like, I thought, tell me, I don't know
yeah,
that reference.
You don't know how McLuhan became famous. I was behind the scenes in this, but just go with the public record.
Okay.
It's not on the public record other than my statements that I was behind the scenes. But there is a public record. You get Don Thiel's book on the called The Virtual Marshall McLuhan with an appendix by McLuhan's best buddy, Ted Carpenter, where Carpenter talks about watching McLuhan being made famous. Now, what he did, he attended the meetings in San Francisco at Howard Gossage's ad agency. As a matter of fact, I hope I still have it. There's an interesting article on retrospective about Howard Gossage by someone in San Francisco, which was just done recently, talking about what an amazing ad. He was the king ad prankster. I mean, he just created all kinds of sales, sold a lot of stuff. He was the genius of advertising, at least on the West Coast. Mary McLuhan has personally told me some aspects of it. Howard Gossage and Jerry Feigen, I think, who was a doctor, they were flying to New York for other reasons, and they were reading Understanding Media on the plane. And I don't know if it was a private jet. It must have been. I'm not sure. The story is they read the book, and they said, geez, this guy's a genius. Let's go meet him. And they forced the plane to be redirected from New York to Toronto.
Wow.
And they come to him. McLuhan's never heard of him. Walks in. They walk into the office at McLuhan's Center for Culture and Technology and make this proposal that we're going to put on a McLuhan Festival, and we think you're great, and we're going to make you famous. Okay? McLuhan said, well, screw you. He could have said that. But what he did is he had some meetings in San Francisco with Gossage, and Ted Carpenter describes those meetings because he attended them too. And he is, and Ted Carpenter's of the temperament, he doesn't want McLuhan to be a sellout, and Ted Carpenter himself wouldn't do it. But he watches how Gossage and them say, we're going to get your name in all these articles, and Carpenter presents it as very cynical, what Gossage and them are doing, and he's upset that McLuhan's going along with it. And then he says in this article at the back of Don Thiel's book, he says, my God, all the articles showed up for the next 2 years. Gossage pulled it off. He made McLuhan famous because he had that clout being a top advertising PR guy.
Okay.
So Gossage makes McLuhan famous, and Ted Carpenter thinks McLuhan's over his head. He doesn't understand McLuhan knows exactly what he's doing. He's now entering the global theater Android meme. He knows he'll be totally misinterpreted and all garbled, and he writes that this will happen, and yet goes into it because he knew he has to implant his meme in the Android meme.
Right.
You don't exist unless you're in the media. So he advertently attained it. He didn't care about it, okay?
Yeah.
He knew it was one of his strategies. Just like what? What would be one of Zappa's strategy would be go do the PMRC. Zappa knew that he would get a lot of attention doing it because he knew he would do it well.
Right.
Okay, so McLuhan said, well, there's another way to get attention, and then people can see my serious questions I pose, my serious analogical mirror or anti-environment I provide. And then it says, and his jargon is nice as misused plagiarism. Now, it's true. You could say McLuhan plagiarizes if you understand that McLuhan never had an opinion himself. He just would take quotes from all over the place and fit him into his sensory profile bias. You know, this guy has a visual bias. That guy has an acoustic bias. This guy is tribal. This guy is literate. He would, you know, so what does he mean by misused plagiarism? It was actually very well used plagiarism. I mean, he attributed the quotes, but it's, you could say if someone is just quoting people, then he appears not to be being creative.
Right.
This charge is thrown at me all the time. Well, what's being creative is that you're showing the collage of the information environment and showing all these different perspectives, showing the common denominator, and then critiquing that common denominator.
Right.
And it would appear to be jargonized.
And is it not exactly what Aesthetics of Rock is trying to do in some ways?
Yes. He's trying to do it on a puny, very tiny little scale within...
Sure. But, I mean, it's funny that he's throwing this this idea at... towards McLuhan.
He's doing the same thing as he did to Zappa. He does not recognize they're doing the same thing that he's doing.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying, yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
so? It's maybe time to end?
You know what? Just to put a neat finish on it, or, well, not that there's such a thing as a neat
finish. Well, you came to an insight. You get the pattern I'm talking. That's good. We should rest. Well, no, we can carry on. you go, yeah, I get you, Bob. So these statements by Meltzer are really good statements. They're good material to work with. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't agree with them, but they're great words, and they are a level of sophistication that we can then clarify.
Right. Well, you mean you don't agree with the one regarding McLuhan specifically?
No, this statement by McLuhan, by Meltzer on McLuhan, the footnote, McLuhan's only move is the pop says he's inadvertently attained, his jargon is nice, his misused plagiarism. I agree with that, say, 49%.
Yeah.
But there's a 51% level that Meltzer doesn't know that I can use, but I can express, but I can't express it unless I have a great statement like this.
Right, yeah. Okay, it's another thing to use to get to...
To refine what's really going on. Look at the very bottom. Oh, before I go to the bottom, this is what Ben says. He loves talking to me because I help him refine what he thinks because I give him chewable stuff that he can work with. Meltzer gives us chewable stuff, good quality stuff to swallow and shit out, you know, and expel. But look at the very bottom. He goes, and the snatcher is something stupid, is more of the same old, great, impotent, but now incestuous swill, in brackets, unity of form and content. That's exactly what McLuhan says happens under global theater conditions, unity of form and content. And he doesn't know. See, Meltzer's just arriving at a perception of sophisticated perception level that he doesn't know McLuhan has, and if he studied McLuhan, then he wouldn't have to spew all this stuff out and struggle to get it. He'd realize, oh, McLuhan got it, and then figure out how to understand McLuhan and realize, well, what I'm seeing is what McLuhan's pointing out.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder why he did quote McLuhan in that article.
Because it's part of the icons of the day. Rock music is the icon, the news of the day, and he's mixing in all the newsy stuff, the Monkees, Andy Warhol, this and that, happenings. He's scanning the environment.
So do you think, did many people who wrote about McLuhan in the 60s, like, did they understand it? I mean, I know there were some sort of stupid reviews of him and stuff, and
nobody.
I don't know. I mean,
nobody. The only guy who was close was Don Thiel, and he wrote he ended up president of Trent University. He's a well-respected professor, and other professors that knew him because he helped do the Explorations magazine with McLuhan and made the proposal. He wrote the proposal that Carpenter McLuhan put together as a 23-year-old about, 22-year-old, in Toronto in 52 for the Ford Foundation that got the grant. But anyways, Thiel was an insider. Mm-hmm. And he wrote a book on McLuhan, and it came out in 1971 called The Medium is a Rearview Mirror. And many of his colleagues said it was the best book of McLuhan, and it is, until the second book he did on McLuhan in 2001 or 2002, I think. But the point is that even Thiel, his book was so good that McLuhan tried to stop it being published.
Really?
Oh, yeah, it's a whole story. You can read it at the back of the virtual Marsh McLuhan. There's an appendix by Ted Carpenter, which I was just telling you about, and then there's an appendix by Don about the suppression of the Medium is a Rearview Mirror, and it's a very interesting thing. And if you want to be educated, you got to read that book. It will give you, and then you figure out what it means. But, so Thiel was the only one who did it, but he got it so... He didn't get it perfectly right, and McLuhan took issue with it.
Right.
Okay, so why am I? What were we saying? So nobody got it, and even Ted Carpenter.
Tom Wolfe or none of those guys, obviously.
What?
Like Tom Wolfe or none of those.
Nobody.
They just wrote about his personality, really, in some ways.
They were puppets in his theater. He knew they wouldn't get it. He knew they didn't understand what he was talking about. But I was going to say that Ted Carpenter didn't even get the 60s McLuhan.
Okay.
And dropped out from it. And I've talked to Ted about that. I mean, he's like Meltzer. McLuhan sold out, you know, and
right.
was a hack. And I tell you, you want inside information, you read Don Thiel's The Virtual Marsh McLuhan, read his story of how McLuhan tried to suppress the book, and they brought in 5 university presidents to resolve it.
Wow.
And because it was the first book being launched by McGill Queen's University Press. It just started in 71, and this was their launch pad rocket ship book. And then McLuhan botched it up. under the impact of his agent, Matty Molinaro, which is another thing. But then you read Ted Carpenter's appendix on how he saw the changes McLuhan went through. You need to know what these very intelligent insider people thought happened to McLuhan. And I say you need to know that because McLuhan's very important, and you need to know about what his buddies thought of what happened to then get to the point of understanding what I'm saying about McLuhan.
Yeah, okay.
That's real rock criticism, Don Thiel's book.
Okay, I'll look into that.
Yeah, and when you have time. So I think you were going to say something else.
I was going to say we've got two options here. We could wrap it up, or if you wanted to go back to that one quote.
Zappa?
To look at the Zappa.
Yeah, let's look at that.
Let's look at that and end after that.
Okay, so he says... He quotes John Tingley. You know,
right.
John Tingley, I think he's an artist named on Freakout by Zappa.
Oh, really? Okay.
He has a few, you know, modern artists in that 189 name list, or 179
okay.
name, something like that.
Okay.
I think it's Tingley might be on there. John Tingley's self-destroying machines, that's accurate, McLuhan and Zappa would understand that, have sometimes not worked and have thus failed to fail. That's very important. Remember McLuhan,
yeah.
Zappa writes in his autobiography about how important it is to be able to handle failure. And he's all for failure. So did McLuhan say that. So here's the young Meltzer kind of intuiting that's what modern art should do. Because you don't want to set up any hypnosis. Anyways, Bohm's, and he's the famous mystic for 300 years ago, I assume that's what he means, or Bedyev's, ordered suggestions of primary chaos, or yours and mine, that's very good. You know, you have primary chaos, that's the global theater. Or yours and mine, you're all in the same media environment, can therefore be viewed in the same light as positive inconsistency. Now that's, the inconsistency is just nonlinear acoustic space tribal stuff. And McLuhan would look at that clinically. It's a little too subjective saying positive inconsistency. You know what I mean?
Okay.
Unless you're trying to be tactile, and then you would be a collage of inconsistency, and that's what McLuhan did. And so did Zappa. John Lennon, once apparently working toward D. Gerber's highest conception of art, that of senseless masochism. Now, that's true. If you're going to be an old-fashioned artist, you're going to be beat up. You know, you're going to be famous for 15 minutes. And so if you're conscious of that, you can put on being senselessly masochistic. So John Lennon once prolifically endeavoring to build a... Okay, John Lennon once apparently working toward... prolifically endeavoring to build a toothpick pyramid that would blow away overnight. Okay, so that's we now understand why he says in his footnotes senseless masochism in italics, because
right,
it's a
right.
conscious act.
Right.
You know, senseless masochism. But that of Frank Zappa of the Mothers of Invention surpasses Lennon's, because there's where he thinks Zappa is trying to be the high art top of the mountain guy.
Yeah, yeah.
Doesn't recognize Zappa's not trying to do that, though Zappa would put on that for those that need it, surpasses Lennon's because the former Zappa seems to have missed, perhaps by having become too old for a while. Too old would be too literate, too master genius, the
right.
old Gutenberg archetypes, but Zappa didn't do that, but it could be projected on the teen industry, rock industry, that Zappa was doing that. So he's saying Zappa, that Zappa fails because he surpasses Lennon's and actually, quote, achieves something, right?
Right, right, okay, yeah.
Because he became too old, that means became like the older generation who grew out of the Depression, the pre-boomer generation, who back in those days tried to have an identity. But the young, hip baby boomers know you can't have an identity in the global theater. So Zappa accidentally went too old just for a while, that means he put on being a great artist, capital A artist, great composer, present-day composer refuses to die, you know, the quote from Perez.
Right.
Okay, so he says Zappa, he doesn't know that Zappa is not doing that. It looks like Zappa's doing that, and Zappa, fails better than Meltzer and
right.
celebrates it.
Right.
Remember his famous quote, how would you like to be remembered, Frank? Oh, I hope I'm not remembered at all, and I don't think I will be remembered.
Okay,
so the whole sequence of look at that. These are very good words. But that of Frank Zappa, the Mothers, surpasses Lennon's because Zappa seems to have missed a whole sequence of English rock explosions. There's the Be Famous for 15 Minutes. That's what McLuhan said. A rapid series of innovations is Aerostat's environment. within the teenage music world, they got to have new groups coming through every 3 months, being the new thing and upsetting whoever was famous the previous 3 months.
Right.
And there are a series of rock explosions, and they appeared for the teenager to be anti-environmental, giving them new insights. Cream was way better than Jerry and the Pacemakers.
Right.
Okay, so the kids, wow, look at this. This is 2 years later, 1967. Cream is great. Pacemakers are good in 65. And so they go through a change and adapt to the new innovation. But it is just a fake innovation. It's an innovation, but it's a fake anti-environment. Only lasts a few minutes. Which Meltzer is getting that. The whole sequence of English rock explosions, ersatz anti-environment. But that's just in the puny world of rock for the consumption of kids within the Android meme. And McLuhan's talking about that same phenomenon on all fields all over the world.
Right, okay, yeah.
Consequently, Zappa thinks he has to bother with empty parodies of early rock emptiness, because there is Meltzer recognizing that these are ersatz anti-environments, the rock explosions, and
right.
So you don't have to parody emptiness, because everybody, he thinks instinctively, knows they're empty. And it
right.
doesn't matter that they're empty. But that's, he gets himself tied up in a knot here. Zappa knows that. And in the article he writes on Zappa in 77, he questions whether Zappa did parody the 50s stuff because of Cruisin' with Room and the Jets is such a great album. It seems
right.
to have love in it. So later, 10 years later, he's a little not so sure about saying this. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
And he leaves it up in the air. He can't decide. Consequently, you know, see, you can look at that encounter with Zappa in 77.
Yeah.
He is meeting the master. It doesn't mean anything to him. Ripe to become a punk. Then punk comes along and he can just blow off his frustration.
Right, okay.
I have to tell you that what's amazing about that article is he answers a question that I always had, because he quotes Zappa. In 76, I read a quote by Zappa where it was some gossip paper in L.A., and I was in L.A., and it describes how Zappa ran into the big music store and scarfed up all the latest albums, and they were saying, what the hell's going on, Frank? Why are you buying this bullshit, you know, AM radio or just rock radio,
yeah,
FM radio
yeah.
stuff? And Zappa says, I got to find out what's going on. And he runs out of the store, and that's reported. I never had a chance to ask Zappa what went on there. Well, Meltzer read that and had a question about it. He actually solved the question I've had for 30 years. It was 35 years of 76 to, this is 33 years later.
Yeah.
And I didn't know that article, so Zappa gives a statement on it, which sort of answers what I thought Zappa was doing. Zappa was just trying to find out what the Android meme was doing.
Right.
That's what he
right.
says. Zappa says, I want to find out what these musicians are doing. He actually expressed interest in what these musicians were doing in the way they were playing. But
right.
you know Zappa was just, that was the news for Frank. Okay, let's find out, he was doing McLuhan. Let's find out what the tribes are doing, what their rhythms are, and then I will satirize those rhythms.
Right.
He was
right.
not consuming right. them because he admired them. He wanted to find out how they did it and then make fun of it.
Yeah, it's almost like researching almost.
He was researching, like he was doing an inventory of the society within the rock world, like McLuhan did on a broader level.
Yeah.
So, consequently, Zappa thinks he has to bother with empty parodies of early rock emptiness without realizing the Beatles and everybody else have coped with that work problem and gotten it well out of the way and or internalized it as second nature roughage. There's a McLuhan term, second nature roughage. Just leave it, just keep it that. And that is senseless masochism, especially when there's nothing else left from before to bother with. In other words, there's no reason to do satire on the emptiness, says Meltzer, and the Beatles and the rock English rock guys realize that. Let's just go out and make money, or let's just have fun.
Right.
Meltzer doesn't know that. Zappa's doing that as well, but Zappa includes in his fun pretending he's a serious composer and putting that on to bug people.
Right.
So Meltzer fails to get the comprehensive Zappa. He's right. If Zappa was doing that, then he's right. You don't need to satirize what's empty. You just join in and create your own empty products.
Right, okay.
And that's senseless masochism, because if you become well-known with your empty product, you'll get beat up by the press, like the Beatles did.
Yeah.
But you do it as conscious as possible, you celebrate it. Senseless masochism. Most of the rock stars, English rock, whatever, they didn't do it. They all became junkies and died. They couldn't take it. Only Zappa remained above it all, so to speak, and survived his fame and the media abuse. And so Meltzer is right to point out the emptiness of music in the global theater. That's what he's doing. It's not right. even worth satirizing. Just enjoy it as it explodes around you. But even he gets exhausted a year or two later, can't take it anymore.
Yeah.
And gotten it well out of the way and or internalized it as second nature roughage, and he never parodies much of England except Donovan. I don't know about that. Too much dues to pay to archaeology and art as imitation. So Frank ends up back in high school. And that's nice, too. See, even... Now, there's Meltzer doing it to himself. He's not going to get too worked up that Frank screwed up.
Right.
His version of Frank screwed up, and he says, that's nice, too.
That's nice, too,
He's actually on my level, almost. He accepts it. But he has to write something, so he's just be in Frank's face. Just to separate himself from all the other people who think Frank is great.
Right, okay.
So he says, too much dues to pay to archaeology and art as imitation. That's partly right, but not totally what Zappa was doing. Zappa was doing it because he thought it was nice, too.
So
Zappa was just playing with the music, with the 50s, because he liked it.
So is Meltzer trying to say there that he's trying to turn this into art or something?
Are you saying is Meltzer trying to turn his writing into art?
No. Is Meltzer claiming that about Zappa? Like when he's saying too much dues to pay to archaeology and art as imitation.
Yeah, he's saying Frank is being too much the old artist and
right. Okay.
And ends up back in high school.
Ends up back in high school, just making that stuff for fun anyway.
Okay, so Frank ends up. So what he's saying is that Frank is trying to be a serious artist and parody what doesn't need to be parodied. And if you do that, you're back in high school taking courses on art and archaeology and trying to be a good, modern, up-to-date, postmodern archaeologist.
Okay,
but then, see, Meltzer is describing, within the rock world, exactly the Finneganese and McLuhan perception. But he doesn't know it.
Right.
He doesn't know that. This book is good, Aesthetics Rock, because he's describing the nothingness of music and how vital tactile nothingness is, and he doesn't know McLuhan did it already and explained it.
Right.
So he's the baby boomer's replay of McLuhan and Joyce's sensibility about the information environment, and more evidence proving McLuhan. He doesn't know he's proving McLuhan's point.
Right.
Now, that's McLuhan didn't write a lot about rock, but there's key things he wrote, and he's not only explaining rock, he's explaining why Stephen Hawking shows up in quantum physics or string theory. He's explaining all the fields, why there's a new kind of economist, why Carter is president. He's covering the whole global situation.
Well, that's the thing, though. I mean, for someone, especially someone of Meltzer's age, it doesn't matter how intelligent the guy is. I mean, in 1966 or 67, whatever, and unless, like, why would... That would be an incredible leap for him to be reading McLuhan's stuff and in some ways being able to apply it to rock, or think that McLuhan's stuff could be applied to rock.
Like, right.
That would just be a big leap at the time, I think. I mean...
And that's why I'm the greatest rock critic. I come in and clarify what they didn't know they were doing.
Right.
I mean, he's a young genius, Meltzer, perceptive person, and he's too young to get the scope. He has to grow up. He has to get an identity. He has to get a job and all that stuff. And McLuhan is in 66. He's 55 years old. You know, I mean, he's an old guy. He's seen and read a lot more and understood and interacted with famous people. Meltzer is just beginning that route.
Right.
And Meltzer burns out and drops out of it. So how is he going to understand what McLuhan's doing? You need to wait 40 years till I show up to explain what was going on back then. Because I did my homework. I understood McLuhan.
Right.
Okay. It would have been interesting to... I mean, I'd read these guys in Cream and say, well, too bad they don't have me to talk to. I used to call up Cream and talk to Bangs occasionally and harass him. And say,
oh, really?
Yeah, I used to call him up. This is in 74, 75 when he was still in... Detroit, right? Isn't that where Cream was? And I'd always call up with something about, use the NLP technique. You know what NLP is? The CIA, if you meet someone, you figure out what their sensory bias is, and you mirror back their sensory bias, usually by which way they look with their eyes.
Okay.
And then you figure out their sensory bias, and then you become that sensory bias, and they'll immediately warm up to you because you've matched with their bias.
Right.
And then you work on them because they've opened themselves up. I would do that bang. I would call up and then mention something in cream or something that would show that I'm a sort of an intelligent fan. And then I'd start flipping it once we get talking. And I'd start telling them, look, you're an idiot. You don't even know about Finnegan's Wake or McLuhan, blah, blah, blah. So I may not, I don't know if I said that to him, but I said something like that.
Right, and what was his response?
He'd hang up. He would, after a while, he recognized my voice, and he didn't know who I was, but he recognized me, and he knew he would eventually hang up, but he didn't do it impolitely. He would say, okay, Bob, that's enough. I'm going. I'd, okay, bye.
Well, see, Bob, what you should have done was call him up late at night. Because apparently Bangs used to get drunk and like talking on the phone late at night for hours, so.
That's right. He would talk for a while, but eventually, I mean, I could talk to him for half an hour before I turned the knife on him. You know what I mean?
Right, okay.
But at first, I just turned into someone that I don't know who this guy is. He's switching on me, so he hang up. But when I kept calling, after a while, he'd know who I was, and he'd kind of know the pattern, so he'd entertain it for a while. And then I'd start to come up with another way of doing it, and it would surprise him, and then he'd be polite and say, okay, there you go, you're turning on me, okay, that's it, I gotta go, I'm hanging up. So he would tell me he was hanging up.
Okay.
And I even did it to Andy. I did it to all kinds of people. Andy Warhol did all kinds of things like that.
Wow.
Phone terrorist, you know.
Yeah.
but I was always saying what I'm saying today. I said, you guys are screwing up. You're not doing what you could do. And then I would go, and that's nice too. That's good, you're screwing up. Well, I've said, you know, ignorance creates wealth.
Right, okay.
Okay, so we've done, so anyways, it's good that I'm glad to get this on the record. I mean, it's like we meet Meltzer and Chris Kelly. This is your life. This is what you didn't do. This is what you did. This is what you didn't do. The high school principal showing up to mark their papers.
Yeah. Okay. So what do you think? Should we? Did you have anything else about that?
Well, it's interesting. Right below that, he has the thing we read is
footnote seven,
but it's footnote eight where he quotes Bob Dylan.
That's right.
And he says, an evening's empire has returned into sand. That's a really good line, and it will end with this. The evening's empire is the top song on the that night, okay, on the radio that kids like. I mean, they used to phone in and vote for some song and some new thing. Has returned, 15 minutes are up. Has returned into sand. But it's hyphenated. It's interesting. It could return because it can come back and have an empire again for a while and then go back and go into sand. It's recycled. So actually, this is a footnote to this whole thing, endeavoring to build a toothpick pyramid that would blow away overnight. That is a very good description of the meaning of the Dylan line. I mean, that's excellent criticism there. He's saying Dylan's line, he explains Dylan's line, an evening empire has returned into sand, by saying, endeavoring to build a toothpick pyramid that would blow away overnight, you know, after it's 15 minutes after the DJ went off the air.
Right.
I mean,
and that's what the medium does.
Yeah, that's what the way the kids live. I mean, they'll talk about who won the song the next day in school, but then the next night it's all start a new contest.
Okay. Yeah.
People live 200 years every 12 months.
Right. Okay.
They did back then. Now they don't live, and they're, in deep freeze coma for millions of years.
Okay.
They're immortal. Don't know it.
I think that's a good thought to end this call.
Okay.
So that was great, Bob. Let's do it next week.
Yep. It's very good, and I'm glad we got It's always good stuff to work with that you found here.
Excellent. No, some good stuff again. I'll have lots to play back and try and figure out and absorb. So.
Yep.
Good stuff. I'm busy for the week ahead.
All right, you are. You're definitely back in high school.
Yeah.
You got homework to do.
Exactly.
Okay, but it's like reading what you come up with is like reading this stuff. See, well, your responses to me
it's fun homework, first of all. I mean.
Yeah. It's what you want to do, what you want to know.
Exactly.
So the questions you bring up are inspirational for me to come up with stuff, just like reading this Meltzer is inspirational.
Yeah, okay, good. Yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, I think it's just, I mean, it's funny, too, there's still a crap load of stuff to go through, obviously. So.
Yeah. No, we might be coming around to the same point all the time, but you don't get that point unless you look at it from whole different aspects in the kaleidoscope.
Exactly, and I am, I'm very sort of curious to, you know, I'm actually good staying in Meltzer for a little while still.
Because, yeah.
You know, there's still some territory to explore there and everything, but...
Well, it's crazy enough. It's accurately crazy. I mean, senseless masochism, this is good stuff. I mean, beats all the other guys.
Well, I'm kind of curious to see what happens even just to the conversation when we get to some of the other guys.
Yeah, yeah.
So...
Okay.
I have a feeling I'll be sort of, you know, saying, no, but this guy's good, but... You know, we'll see.
Yeah, no, I mean, we're beginning at the beginning, and we don't have to go any further. We will, but Meltzer, look, I mean, this is most people reading it. What the hell is this? They can't understand it. They won't know what he's talking about.
Yeah.
He's got some good, he's up to date on the art world, you know, from his professor friend, Alan Kaprell, you know. To say John Tingley's self-destroying machines, who knew about that, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
I don't think Goldstein or Christgau or Bangs in 1960. Well, this could have been written in 65, 66. You know, it's written over several years. They probably didn't know about it. But he knew about it because he was hanging out with a famous artist.
Yeah.
He was getting a good education at whatever school it was he went to.
I'd love to interview Alan Kaprell about Meltzer. I wonder if he's even still alive.
Well, you just need to wiki it.
Yeah.
Are we taping what we're saying now?
I assume Scott's... I've got my backup tape going, but I don't know...
Okay, so let's go. Let me
hear me, Bob. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, we're taping.
Okay, good. We thought it was sort of the end, but I'll just put in Alan Kaprell and see if he's still alive. Kaprell. I think that's his name.
Oh, you know what, guys?
He died April 5th, 2006.
Oh, jeez. Okay.
He was born in 1927. See, like, he's in his almost 40 when he's a, you know, bona fide arrived artist when he's dealing with the young Meltzer.
Okay, guys, you know what? This is good timing. My baby's actually crying through the monitor. So I
Okay, so great talking to you.
We'll talk soon.
Okay, Scott. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, guys. Bye-bye.
Bye.